Hello and welcome to the Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. This week, our guests are the congressional candidate for the 7th District in New Jersey, Democrat Rebecca Bennett, and our favorite political journalist, Ron Brownstein of CNN and Bloomberg Opinion. Now, remember, we love taking your questions, so write to politicswarroom@gmail.com for next week's show. We'll get to as many as we can, but don't forget to tell us where you're from. You also can text updates about what's next for Politicon and Politics War Room by signing up at politicon.com. So tell your friends about us and remind them to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. And please check out the links to our sponsors, Trust and Will, and Miracle Made, Quince, and Aqua True, and our episode show notes. We thank you for supporting these sponsors. It helps make this podcast happen. This is an explosive week in politics, and who better to shed some insight than Ron Brownstein, the political analyst for CNN and columnist for Bloomberg Opinion, and no one knows or writes better about American politics. Grand Planner is going to have to drop out of this race, but there does not seem to be any natural replacement. Most of the major possibilities in Maine have lost primary for governor, other things. There's no clear process as to what to be done. But just thinking with an eye to the Biden-Harris situation of several years ago, they have to have, don't they, an open process, yeah. If brief, it only can be 2 weeks, and then have some group, state committee, whatever have you, pick a nominee after maybe a debate. But you tell me, you know more about it than any of us do.
Well, you know, I guess I feel like there are, and wrote, as I wrote in June, I think there are reasonable alternatives for Maine Democrats. It was sort of a concentration or concentration of errors that produced this primary, because on the one hand, this outcome, Plattner did touch a chord early on, right? I mean, he did. I mean, there is a genuine response to him that goes beyond the extent to which I believe national progressive groups saw him as a way to make a point. Yes, but he ultimately did touch a chord among Maine voters. But part of what happened was that no organic alternative really emerged, because the national Democratic leadership was so invested in the governor, Janet Mills, as, you know, their choice, that prevented anybody else, I think, or preempted anybody else from getting in the race. And one of the results of that, Al, was that they ended up having five serious candidates in the gubernatorial race. I mean, you know, the main gubernatorial, Democratic gubernatorial primary was where all of the talent flowed. And, they had right. a number of candidates who did really well and showed statewide appeal. Hannah Pingree, who was the eventual nominee, former Speaker of the House, probably would have been the strongest alternative to Plattner in the Senate race. She's now otherwise engaged in the governor's race. But I think the other, you know, three of the other four, I don't think Angus King's son is, you know, necessarily a reasonable choice for the other Senate seat. But Troy Jackson, who former state Senate president, rural district, genuinely working class in a way that, you know, Plattner really was not in his personal background. He endorsed Plattner. Plattner endorsed him. Bernie endorsed both of them. He is a plausible candidate. Shana Bellows, the Secretary of State, who ran against Collins in 2014 when she was much younger, and her only background was that she was head of the state ACLU. She did well in this, and she certainly scratches the itch of voters who want a party that is more committed to resisting Trump. And then Nirav Shah, the former state public health official, who more moderate, also a reasonable choice. So I think out of those three to begin with, I don't think Jerry Golden in all likelihood will reconsider the outgo, and he was probably too much of a poke in the eye to the forces that advance Plattner. But I think between Bellows and Jackson, I think that they have a kind of a candidate who would be acceptable to the broad range of the party and would not seem like a repudiation to the most ardent Plattner folks. And, they don't have a process to get there. It seems like they are in good faith trying to figure out what will get them there. You know, whether it's some kind of statewide convention or caucuses again. I mean, obviously they can't do a primary again after some kind of debate. But I do think that if, you know, I think it's inappropriate for Plattner and his supporters to be kind of demanding more leverage over this. You know, he really.
Yeah, I can't. Yeah. I mean, Plattner is so disgraced.
Yeah.
You don't want to have a candidate right. who's been picked by Plattner.
Right. Right. I mean, that is the thing. I mean, they've got to be careful here. They do not want it to appear as though he is getting to choose his successor. And look, I wrote in June that the candidate that Plattner would probably prefer is Troy Jackson, I would assume. And I also agree that in many ways he is the best alternative, but it should not be, it certainly does not advance the Democratic Party cause that they're trying to beat Susan Collins to have him enter the race, you know, as Plattner tapping him on the shoulder.
Ron, you have, as you've written, both Susan Collins and Donald Trump are really unpopular.
Yeah.
In Maine. This is not the Susan Collins who's always pulled it out. People are kind of fed up with her. But given this situation in a race that was a top Democratic priority, you almost have to consider her the favorite at this point, don't you?
I don't know. That's a really good question. I think, you know, first of all, let's just level set here. You know, as we've talked about before, the big story in Senate politics over certainly my lifetime covering it and yours is that it's become harder and harder for either party to win Senate seats in states that usually vote the other way for president. 25 states have voted 3 times for Donald Trump in all 3 of his races. Republicans now have all 50 of their Senate seats. Democrats hoping to break into that. 19 states have voted 3 times against Donald Trump. Democrats have 37 of their 38 Senate seats. The only exception is Susan Collins. And if you look back at the exit polls in Trump's first term in 18 and 20, in every exit poll conducted in every Senate race, Susan Collins was the only Republican Senate incumbent or challenger who won in a state where Trump's job approval was net negative. She was the only Republican Senate incumbent or challenger who won more than 8% of people who disapproved of Trump. She won 3 times that many in 2020, 23%. So she is an anomaly. She is a unicorn. But things are different. Trump is, I think, more unpopular in Maine. He has been more extreme in the second term than the first. And maybe most important, she stood on the Senate floor and said she was confident Brett Kavanaugh was not going to overturn Roe v. Wade. And then, of course, he voted 2 years after her reelection to do just that. So I think she is weaker. And the question is, what is the task of a Democratic nominee in Maine in this year? Is it to mobilize new voters? Is it to persuade a majority of the state that Donald Trump and the Republicans are taking the country in the wrong direction? I don't think it's either of those things. I think it's simply to be an acceptable alternative to the majority of the state that already believes that.
Right.
And, you know, I think several of these alternatives have the potential to do that. Now, you know, this whole mess does make it more fraught for Democrats, but I certainly think their chances with a fresh nominee are better simply if harvesting, like you probably have to win. Susan Collins, I think, held Sarah Gideon to 71% of people who disapproved of Trump. You probably only have to win 82 or 83% of them to win in Maine, you know?
Let me take you, Ron, 700 miles away to another Senate race in Michigan, where a state legislator, Mallory McMurrow, dropped out. So it's a head-to-head contest. But I look at that, and that's another top. They have to keep that seat. Abdul El Sayed, smart
yes.
physician, but really has left-wing views. I think it's hard to see how they carry in that entire state. Congresswoman Haley Stevens got a lot of backing, a lot of money, but boy, she's not a very good candidate. Republicans have to feel better about Michigan also, don't they? And Democrats have to win one of those two, Maine or Michigan, for control.
Oh, probably both, right? So, you know, in my kind of framework of how I look at the Senate, you've got, as I said, the 19 states that have voted 3 times against Trump. Collins is the last Republican senator. Democrats have to win that. Democrats have to crack back into the 25 three-time Trump states where they now literally have 0 of the 50 Senate seats after having 8 as recently as 2017. And they have chances there. North Carolina, the most obvious, probably followed by Ohio, Alaska, Iowa, and Texas. And then you got the last bucket, the 6 states that have flipped at any point during the 3 Trump races. Democrats now have 10 of their 12 Senate seats, which is probably unsustainable in the long run, but they are defending two in those switch states, flip states. One is Georgia with John Ossoff, where they seem to be in very good shape. And the other is Michigan, where Mike Rogers is a candidate who has the potential to do what Collins did in 2020, which is the Republican candidate, and win an unusually large share of Trump disapprovers. You know, Michigan has some similar qualities to Maine, where, you know, by and large, the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee has had a good recruiting year. They got Cooper in North Carolina. They got Peltola in Alaska. They got Sherrod Brown to run again in Ohio. They have Josh Turek out of the process in Iowa. But in Maine and Michigan, you know, they bet on a horse that has not proved that, you know, not running that well around the track. And so, you know, with Haley Stevens in Michigan and Janet Mills in Maine, I think that misstep, and the fact that they've invested in candidates who just simply aren't that strong has left a lot of room for the left. Now, Michigan is different in Maine, in my mind. I mean, the sin of the left in Maine, as I have said many times before, is that Plattner supporters were so determined to prove that their model of how to win is the right one that they ignored all the evidence that he was simply an imperfect and deeply flawed vehicle to be hanging these hopes on. Michigan is more, you know, you don't have that with El Said. You have what you said, the core question. You know, there are the argument of Bernie and Warren and AOC and their, and, you know, all of their political organizations is that the way Democrats are going to win is by running outsider populists who are running on really lefty programs of single payer healthcare, national wealth tax, abolishing ICE, and cutting off all funding to Israel. That's kind of the four corners of the tent. Here you have more of a pure test of that than you did in Maine, where we never even really got to those questions of whether that was defensible in the general election because Plattner had so many personal vulnerabilities. Here there's a legitimate debate. Okay, have the debate. I agree with you. I think that those positions are going to be hard to win. You know, the paradox of these left populist candidates is they've proven more popular with white college graduates than the non-college working class voters right. They're supposed to appeal to. I'm not sure eliminating private health insurance is a great selling point, you know, to a lot of union members, although I think El Said has tried to move away from that. But Michigan is a pure test of this. And I do think that if El Said is the nominee, and they lose in November, that will have a big impact on how much momentum the left goes into 28 with.
James Carville.
From across, he's across the pond.
I'm in Innsbruck. So Ron, the Plattner rise was also a rise of a different attitude set. It was the consultants of like 27, mm-hmm. 28 years old, and they were not sort of straight-jacketed by the old rules of politics. And it looked like they had some real success. I mean, they won, they knocked the incumbent governor out, couldn't even run, and they were kind of ahead in the polls. But the thing that, like, if I look back on this, you didn't vet your own candidate?
Yeah.
You mean you didn't know? Okay, we used to get our own Oppo researchers to do an Oppo research book on us. It's the most important research you do. And so they took off in this campaign. And all of this was recent. It wasn't way back in some other godforsaken time. I don't think they knew. I don't think they wanted to know.
Yeah.
All right?
Locking and tapping still
it's
matters.
It's an old-fashioned... Yeah, it's so 80s to do a briefing on your own candidate to find out what's wrong with him. But, you know, there's certain rules in politics. So I go in the conversation that you and I had. Is there anything that you see in history, in election returns from in 2025 and 2026, or in polling, that tells you that the Democrats are not going to have a really big year?
Yeah. Well, I think they're the one yellow light on the dashboard for Democrats okay. is what I was talking about before, which is if you look at Trump's first term, In the exit poll in 2018, 90% of people who disapproved of Trump voted Democratic for the House. In 2020, it was 93%. Over those two elections in 2018 and 2020, every Democratic Senate candidate except Sarah Gideon in Maine won at least 89% of voters who disapproved of Trump. So did Sherrill and Spanberger. They won over 90% of voters who disapproved of Trump. By that history, with all indications that gas prices may not go down as much as they hope, you know, more conflict in the Middle East, Trump's disapproval rating stays up near 60%. Democrats should have a very big race. The yellow light on the dashboard is that polling so far is not finding Democrats winning as big a share of the Trump disapprovers as they did in his first term.
On the congressional generic.
The congressional generic, but also, James, all of those New York Times, Siena polls in all of the Senate races, they were not where they needed to be among the Trump disapprovers. So, you know, particularly because so much of this election is being fought out in red terrain, where there are far fewer Republican House members in districts that voted Democratic than there were in 2018. Obviously, every place except Maine in the Senate are places that Trump won, all of them except North Carolina, places he won by double digits. The one yellow light for Democrats is whether there is going to be more than we've seen in the past, a bigger share of voters than we've seen in the past, say, I don't like Trump, but I'm not willing to go to the alternative. That we have not seen much of that historically, as you know well. I mean, I think midterms are overwhelmingly a referendum on the incumbent president. And I think a lot of the people who disapprove of Trump and dislike the Democrats may not vote in the end, and that will give Democrats a boost. But that is the one yellow light. They are not maximizing that Trump disapproval the way they have in the past. And that could be a reflection either of the generic and these races are lagging and they're eventually going to get there, or the Biden presidency happened in the middle, right? Between 18 and 20 and now, there was the Biden presidency, and the Democratic image did take a hit, and there may be more voters than there were in Trump's first term who dislike him but are still not willing to vote for Democrats, especially in places like Ohio and Iowa and Alaska and Texas, where the Senate is going to be decided. So that's what I was.
I'll make a brief comment and certainly respond to it and turn it back to Al. To me, the most important number in polling, I'm not a big, and I think we all would agree, the congressional generic is not a be-all to end-all number.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But I think the most important number in that are, in other polls, is the incumbent's number.
Mm-hmm.
It's not March.
Yeah.
It's incumbent, is the number of the incumbent party. And with reference to the Time Center poll, I would just make the editorial comment, and you talk to a lot of people, you see a lot of that seems to me a little bit on the more optimistic side for Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, all polls, they're plus or minus three in some of them, but that's my general observation about it. I didn't say it's wrong.
Well, I would say, look, you've got in those polls Trump well under 50% approval in Iowa, Ohio, and Texas, and only even at, I think, 47 in Alaska. By historic standards, a Republican should not be able to win a state where Trump's approval is 42%. We don't have an example of that in his first term. There's no state where Republican Senate candidate won where Trump, like I said, Susan Collins in his first term was the only Republican Senate candidate, incumbent or challenger, who won in a state where he was net negative at all, much less, 42-55. I mean, there's no precedent for that. Now, Democrats did do better. They did win four states in 24 in fourth Senate races in states where Harris lost fairly narrowly. But there is no precedent for what those Time Siena polls showed. So, I said that's the yellow light on the dashboard for Democrats. I also believe it's the yellow light on the dashboard for Republicans, because it's like, is your relative, I wouldn't say optimism, but lack of panic about 26 built on a mirage that you can win many more voters who disapprove of Trump than you have in the past. That's the only reason they're in the ballgame right now in these Senate polls and in these generic polls. So is that really a mirage that's a July thing that's going to melt away when, some Democrats have said to me that, that this is just a function of the candidates not being that well known yet. And, maybe it is. But like I said, Trump being, I think it was a 42 approval in both Iowa and Ohio. I mean, those are states where he won 55% of the vote. I mean, those are amazing and ominous numbers for Republicans. And, you know, the fact that the New York Times still had them ahead in those Senate races is a real departure from what we saw in the first term.
All right, Albert.
Ron, let me ask you if there's another semi-yellow light flashing, and that is that the left has won some big congressional victories in New York and Colorado, not just socialists, but some really crazy stuff, you know, empty the prisons, no deportations. Trump and the Republicans are going to try to say that defines the party. Yeah. They've already begun that. They had some success with that, with defund the police 4 or 5 years ago. How much of a concern do you think that should be? And do mainstream Democrats have to actively disown some of that and not just let it sit out there?
So I think that I agree. That is a really big open question. As I've written, by and large, with a few exceptions in the Central Valley, Allentown, one district in Ohio, by and large, the far left candidates are winning in safe Democratic districts, particularly urban districts with a lot of white college graduates. If you look at the three Mamdani candidates who won, and you look at Kyros, who beat DeGette in Colorado and Denver, all of those are districts where Harris won at least 70% of the vote. And a clear majority of the white voters are college graduates. You know, that's kind of the irony here. This kind of left populism is appealing to kind of the white, you know, it's kind of Starbucks socialism in terms of who
Whereas
it's
James calls it the brown faculty lounge.
Exactly. And Colorado is a good example of this. In the swing districts, the Democrats are actually counting on to flip the majority. With the few exceptions I mentioned, they are not nominating these candidates. They are nominating mainstream Democrats who don't want single payer. They want to restore the Medicaid cuts and ACA subsidies, and they want Medicare to negotiate on more prescription drugs. They want to reform ICE. They don't want to abolish ICE. They want limits on USAID to Israel. They don't want to completely ban it. And they want higher taxes on the rich, not the wealth tax. So the big question is, and like, you know, we saw on the same night that Kyros won in Colorado won, Democrats nominated two candidates in that profile, in the profile I've just described, in 5 and 8, which are the two Republican seats they actually hope to flip. That's what happened in New York. New York 17, Kate Conley against Mike Lawler was nominated on the same night the Mamdani candidates won they're making blue places bluer. So the question is, and I think it's an open question, can Republicans hurt the relatively moderate Democratic candidates, mainstream Democratic candidates in swing districts by tying them to the far left candidates in the safe seats? You know, I will point out that in 2018, they tried the same thing with AOC and the Squad when they first emerged in the Democratic primaries, and it didn't work. I mean, Democrats still won over 40 House seats. Now, one Republican said to me this week, okay, but that was, at that point, our examples were like the starting squad of a basketball team. Now we have like the starting squad of a football team. We have more examples, basically.
That's
true. So I think that is a big open question. I am dubious you can beat Kate Conley by tying her to, you know, the Mamdani candidates in New York. But, you know, given the reason for Democrats to be concerned about what you just mentioned, I think is what I said before. Look at where the race is being, the House and Senate is being fought out. It is not being fought out on neutral terrain. It is being fought out on Republican-leaning terrain. In 2018, there were 25 House Republicans in districts that voted for Clinton 2 years earlier, many of them white-collar suburban districts that Republicans were clinging to by their fingernails. Now, apart from the California and Utah redistrictings, there are 3 House Republicans in districts that voted for Harris. And I think 2/3 of the districts that the DCCC is targeting have more non-college graduates than average. And obviously, as I said, you know, 4 of the top 6 Democratic Senate targets are in states that Trump won by double digits. So if this argument is going to work anywhere, those are the kind of places it can work. And, you know, again, from 2018, I wouldn't say there are great odds that it will work, but it may have an effect. And, you know, again, go back to what we were talking about before, Al, which is, why aren't Democrats where they need to be among Trump disapprovers? Is it just a polling delay? Is it because the candidates aren't known? Or is it because their party image is weaker than it was in 2018 and 2020? And will this make the party image weaker, at least in those places that they have to win?
Ron, you mentioned Israel a minute ago, and a couple months ago, I thought that too might be a problem, a divisive problem for Democrats. I don't think so as much. I think the country, the public has so turned on Netanyahu, has changed his views. The position of mainstream Democrats is basically isn't much different than the Trump and Vance position. And I think a candidate, and whether it's North Carolina or Alaska, can support the state of Israel, be anti-Netanyahu, condition military aid, and be for a Palestinian state without suffering.
In a general election, I completely agree. I mean, I think the issue is in the primary, the extent to which, being essentially defining what Israel did in Gaza as genocide and being for a complete cutoff of aid. I think Netanyahu, I've written as far back as 2013 and 2014. I think he has behaved both in the region and in his involvement in domestic politics as if he needed support only from the right wing of the Republican Party. And I think, as I wrote earlier this year, I think the end result of that is that he will end up with a stable, Israel will end up with reliable support from neither party. In the U.S. And I think they have that. You've covered politics even longer than I have. I've never seen anything like the decline in Israel's standing in the U.S. in the last couple of years. Enormous miscalculations, both in what they did in Gaza. They were willing to alienate the world, to impose collective punishment. I don't know the legal definition of genocide, but I feel comfortable saying that what they did was collective punishment. They are paying a price for it. And the hole that he has dug is going to be very difficult to dig out of. But I agree, getting through the primaries is a big problem for Democrats. But in a general election, a candidate with the positions you laid out is not really going to face any issue.
Also, the views towards AIPAC has really hurt Israel. I mean, they have done some awful things. They used to be a great force. They aren't.
I will say not only AIPAC has become a force, basically advancing a far right, helping the far right of the Republican Party, but even groups that were more mainstream, like the ADL, they kind of played footsie with Trump's authoritarian actions on immigration, deportations, detention.
Yes.
They have seriously, the putative friends of Israel have seriously miscalculated the way they have handled almost everything around the last few years. And they have contributed to marginalizing Israel's position in the Democratic Party to the point where, it is pretty toxic. And I've seen twice Quinnipiac has polled on Netanyahu's favorability in the last year. Among Democrats, it's 4 to 5%. I mean, it's you're talking about friends and immediate family at that point. So I think this is an important moment. And I think that, Rahm Emanuel is in Israel this week, delivering a critical speech. I think Biden, as on the border, seriously mishandled Gaza. He was kind of trapped in the past, as he was on many issues. But I think no Democratic president can ever be as deferential to Israel again. But I don't think you necessarily have to go as far as Chevalier and so forth.
Yeah. And more Democrats are really taking that position. James Carville.
That one question before I let Ron go here real quick. A friend of mine who I won't mention the name, we both know, Hurt said something I thought was really profound and true. Israel doesn't even try to get us to like them.
Yeah.
They used to have exchanges and you would go over there, and if you went on TV, you would get talking points. And there was a kind of robust promotion and defense of the state of Israel. They don't even try anymore. I mean, they don't have a PR campaign.
Look, they've concluded they only need to mollify the right wing of the Republican Party. And that's been Netanyahu's strategy for quite a while. And it's not only that. I mean, they behaved in a way after October 7th was, horrible, historic. But they behaved in a way that they had to know was going to alienate most of the world. And they did it anyway. And they have continued to behave as if they believe they can solve all their problems at the point of a gun, which, really has not worked out that well through history. Can I go back real quick, Al, to your point? Someone who we all know and James has worked with closely, Stan Greenberg. You know, your point is really interesting, which is, you know, post 24, do Democrats who don't agree with the left on these things have to make that clear, right? Because even before this upsurge on the left, which I believe is driven more by a desire to see Democrats show fire against Trump and to turn the page for new leadership than it is necessarily a full-scale embrace of some, you know, Democratic socialist wish list agenda. Even before this upsurge, you know, the question of whether Democrats had a reposition on some of the issues that had hurt them in 24, particularly immigration and some of the transgender rights issues, that was live in the party. And my feeling was that by 28, the leading Democratic candidates were almost certainly going to do that, the presidential candidates. By and large, they've tried to do so quietly without getting into a big fight. And Stan Greenberg, drawing on the 92 experience, and here we can turn to James in a second, you know, Stan says that's the wrong strategy. If you're going to reposition, you have to have the fight. You have to show the only way to get voters to know that you are putting your party in a different direction is to affirmatively seek out a fight with the forces that you are kind of shifting away from. And, you know, it'll be interesting to see if any of these Democratic candidates this year, you know, like, I don't know what in Colorado 5 does the Army veteran woman, Jessica Killen, I think her name is, does she push off against Kyros? Does Conley in New York say, look, I don't agree with those candidates on these things?
I think Conley will for sure.
Yeah. So that's an open question. It's a bigger question for 28. Do you kind of quietly say, you know, yeah, we've got to be tougher on the border. We have to deal with abuse of the asylum system. Or do you go out and just kind of put a, you know, shine a light on it? James, what do you think?
I don't know. I just don't know. Yeah. I never thought I'd see this. I'm having a little bit trouble adjusting to it, both politically and just personally. But I just don't know, Ron. Yeah. I appreciate the question, but I don't have a good answer.
Yeah. It's one that people are going to grapple with.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of grappling going on, I can tell you that.
James, wrap up this fascinating conversation with Ron Brownstein. You must have one or two more questions before we have to let Ron go.
No, I mean, I'm just delighted we had Ron, and I know you had to fit us in the schedule, and I can't tell you how much we appreciate it. And, you know, I hope we have you back because, you know, we're in the, I don't know, the beginning of the end, or the end of the middle of whatever Churchill said, but we got a lot, just a lot more left to go here. We appreciate you being part of our show and being part of our house.
Can I just say that, Al and James, it's great to be with you. It's, like I said, it's like, you know, Vince Scully and Red Barber asking you to talk baseball with them. It's like, no one's going to say no to that. But I will, to James's point, it really does feel like the clock is speeding up, that we really are engaged now in, you know, the framework of the election. You know, the choices that Democrats are making in these primaries, which, as I say, I think are driven, I think there is a legitimately widespread feeling in the Democratic Party that the party leadership has failed them, manifest in Trump winning again, and probably somewhat unrealistic expectations about how effectively they can push back against him. But nonetheless, I think a lot of Democratic voters are like kind of saying, okay, all you smart people, pundits, pollsters, strategists told us how to beat Trump and you didn't. So they're open to new ideas. I think that is the core of what is driving forward this more than, you know, this vast groundswell among 20 somethings for single payer, you know. I think that kind of thing is probably still more challenge than asset. But I think the Democratic Party, the lesson of 26 is that if the center wants to win in 28, they're going to have to show two things. They've learned from the past and they are committed to fighting the MAGA movement with greater energy than, you know, that they've seen from the party leadership in DC. And, you know, I don't think 26 proves that the left is going to win in 28, but it shows that the center is going to have to fight to maintain control of the party.
So the reason the Democratic Party is in the shape it is because Joe Biden wouldn't get out until July the 21st of the election year. All right. Had Joe Biden gotten out in October of 2023, we would have a Democratic president. Don't kid yourself. And by the way, all the people on the left who say the Democrats don't fight hard enough never said a word about Biden running for re-election. Not any of them. They all fell in the line. And we lost because people wanted a change election and we didn't give it to them. And now they're saying, after we did that, fight, great, okay, wonderful. The flaw in the Democratic Party right now, the reason we have no power, is Biden got out the race too late. And there had been any kind of choice, my personal view is we would have won the thing and it would have been close.
Yeah.
And they didn't say a word.
I'm not as certain that Democrats could have won even if he got out, but there's no question that him staying in reduced their chances further.
You know, I tell you, if they want to look at a model on how to take this on, look at John Ossoff in Georgia.
Yeah.
No one is tougher. No one goes after Trump harder. Not a left winger has anywhere near the compelling case he brings. And he doesn't call for Medicare for all. He doesn't call for defunding the police. But he connects Trump's corruption with people's struggling.
Yeah.
And that's a key point.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Guys, great to be with you.
Thank you. Thank you, Ron. Get your life in order with Trust and Will. I don't know about you, but I would rather control the future of my assets myself as opposed to the Louisiana legislature. And I suspect most of you feel the same way.
This is a confession, not an easy one. We're not getting any younger. And with growing families, you want them taken care of. And whether you're 36 or 80, getting your affairs in order gives you so much peace of mind. Unfortunately, a lot of people get overwhelmed by the paperwork or don't know where to start. That's why we had to tell you, when we saw that Trust and Will, it makes the process easy and affordable with pros ready to help. Now, Trust and Will offers affordable attorney-designed estate plans online you can create in as little as 30 minutes. Their website makes it super easy to create your will or trust online. It's fast. In as little as, I say, 30 minutes, you can create a will that lets you document your wishes for guardians, asset distribution, and healthcare planning. Plus, their products are state-specific and tailored to your needs with attorney support available as an add-on. So update your plan at every life stage with a platform that keeps everything organized, updated, and ready, so your loved ones never face the burden alone. You can also share access with trusted contacts to ensure your will is carried out, and most importantly, it is secure. Trust and Will has bank-level encryption and secure sharing features, so your most important information stays protected and accessible. When we went through this with our young producer, he realized that after getting married, it was time to get it done. Now he tells everyone how fast and simple it was. Trust and Will is the most trusted name in online estate planning, with thousands of five-star reviews on Trustpilot. Trust and Will, affordable estate plans, priceless peace of mind. So go to trustandwill.com/war room and get 20% off. Again, that's trustandwill.com/war room to get your 20% off. trustandwill.com/war room. The link is also in our show notes. Our guest is a decorated Navy helicopter pilot running for public office in New Jersey. It's Rebecca Bennett running against an incumbent Republican, Tom Kaine, in the 7th Congressional District. Rebecca Bennett, thanks for joining us. You face a unique challenge. Your opponent was absent from the House for almost 4 months, came back and said he was being treated for depression, but didn't offer any specifics or whether there's any more treatment. Are you going to demand that he release more, and do you expect to have a head-to-head debate with him?
Well, first of all, Al, thank you so much for having me on. It's great to see you. And, you know, to your question, I've been clear about this from the beginning, which is that what he had shared is that he had a medical condition. I wished him well. I'm glad that he got access to the care that he needs. but he has been failing this district since long before he went missing in March. He was the deciding vote on the One Big Beautiful Bill, which is why tens of thousands of people in my district are losing access to their health insurance. He was nowhere to be found when Donald Trump started yet another forever war in the Middle East. And he was nowhere to be found when ICE tried to put a detention facility in the district. And so we are going to hold him accountable for his record, and we are going to flip the seat in November. I do look forward to debating him, and we are, you know, I plan to look forward to doing that. And if he's not willing to do that, then I will be out all over the district meeting with people, just like what I did in this primary, to make sure that I hear directly from the people that live here so we can solve the issues that we're all facing.
Is that Roxbury Detention Center you just alluded to, is that still a live issue? I thought they put that on hold.
Yes. So it, what we saw, I believe it was last week, they had announced that it was being put on hold. And that's really credit to, you know, Governor Sherrill's administration, as well as the local town council in Roxbury. It's a Republican controlled town council at 7-0. And, you know, what they reached out to Tom Kane Jr. and he told them he didn't want to get involved. And, you know, what is the point of you as a representative if you're not willing to help when you have people reaching out to ask for help for things like that? And so, yes, fortunately, it's been put on hold, but it was not due to anything that was done by Tom Kane Jr. or his office.
Your district is a classic swing district. Mikey Sherrill carried it by 2 points in the governor's race. Trump carried it by a little more than a point in 24. And Trump has embraced Kane. How did Trump and the Big Beautiful Bill now stand or play in New Jersey 7 today?
You know, I think ultimately what I hear from people is that the individual matters so much. And to your point, this district is very purple. It's very moderate. It's split pretty evenly. It's about a third Democratic, a third Independent, a third Republican. And so the way that we flip the seat is by putting together a coalition of not just Democrats, but Independents and, you know, center-right Republicans. And that's how I've led my entire life. You know, I was in the military for 15 years. I'm a former Navy helicopter pilot and test pilot. And that's how we led in the military, is we were just there as Americans to get the job done. And what I hear from people is just this deep frustration with how broken Washington is. And so we desperately need a new generation of leadership that is going to go to Washington and actually be able to get things done. And so that's the mindset that I'm going to bring about making sure that we're actually solving problems that we're all facing.
I'm going to pick up on your military experience in just a moment, but let me ask you this. You beat a more left or a left-wing candidate in the primary rather decisively. But Democratic Socialists have been winning in other places, in New York and Colorado. And the Republicans are determined to label the Democratic Party with that label as a radical label and all that stuff. Is that so, do you have to address that issue and say, no, that's not me, here's who I am? Or can you just ignore it and do your own thing?
Well, I will say, you know, this has been happening all over the country. You know, we've been having Republicans have been meddling in Democratic primaries, and the Republican Party in my primary spent over $650,000 in attack ads, essentially saying that I wasn't left enough. And so, you know, what I told them in my acceptance speech the night of the primaries, I wanted to congratulate them for lighting their money on fire. And for me, I think it goes back to what I heard from people on the ground is, you know, I just want to win. I just want to win. I want to flip this seat. But ultimately, it's about we've got a lower cost of living and we have got to get money out of politics. You know, I feel very strongly we need to end Citizens United. I'm not taking any corporate PAC money. I've also personally divested all of my individual stocks. I believe we need to ban members of Congress from trading stocks. And then, you know, contrast that with what Tom Kane Jr. is doing. He was still trading stocks while he was missing from office. And when he came back to work, the very first thing he did was he held a fundraiser in D.C. to raise money for his campaign. And so I think it's just very clear the contrast between my life of where I've literally been serving this nation between my time in the military and my volunteer work versus what Tom Kane Jr. of just being a career politician has done. And so I think that's how we're going to flip the seat in November.
You know, 15 years in the military, you're devoted, especially to the Navy. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth says he's creating a non-woke fighting force. Apparently, that would include fewer women and fewer black officers. He's fired the respected chief of naval operations, a woman, denied promotions to a number of women and blacks. What impact is that going to have on our fighting force, especially the Navy?
Well, Pete Hegseth is a disgrace to the office that he holds. And, you know, what I would always tell people is that the helicopter doesn't know what gender it is of the person that's flying it. You just got to get the job done. And we should be recruiting our best and brightest from every background and every walk of life to make sure that we're able to get our mission accomplished. That's the beauty of the military, is that we are truly a melting pot of people that come from all backgrounds and all walks of life that just want to serve this country. And so that's what we should be doing, not what Pete Hegseth is doing, which, to your point, is he is firing women and people of color. And so this is one of the reasons why I believe it's so critically important that we're able to flip this seat and take back the House to be able to hold Pete Hegseth accountable, as well as a number of other folks in the administration.
You earlier mentioned the Iran war. Your position is flaring up again. And what's your opponent's position? Do we know?
Well, I'll just say for me, you know, I personally deployed to the Middle East. I flew mission through the Strait of Hormuz, where it was my helicopter in between the Iranian ships and the U.S. Navy. And so anytime we're going to go put American service members in harm's way, there needs to be a clear motivation, clear objective, and a clear exit strategy. And it is abundantly clear that this administration did not have any proper planning before they sleepwalked into yet another forever war in the Middle East. And so I don't know what Tom King Jr.'s position is. I do know that he voted in support of the Iran war early on, and that was his last vote, I believe, he took before he left for about 4 months. But, you know, this is another example of, we need to make sure we have people in office that understand the stakes of this, because ultimately what this means is we've lost, I believe it's now 14 American service members. I just saw this morning that there was another naval aviator that tragically died in the line of duty while deployed overseas. And that's those are the stakes we're talking about. You know, if you're not willing to look those family members in the eye and say that the loss of your loved one was worth it, then what are we doing? And Donald Trump has no idea what that means to be part of something bigger than yourself or to serve. And so that's why I think it's critically important we have more veterans in office to understand the stakes and are going to hold this administration accountable.
Israel, would you vote for placing conditions on any kind of military aid to Israel?
I think that Israel needs to be held to the same standard as all the rest of our allies. I don't think there should be a high standard. I don't think there should be a lower standard. And so to me, it's about how do we make sure we're working towards a two-state solution in the region. You know, I have seen how important Israel is as an ally in the Middle East. I've deployed and worked with the Israeli military, both in my capacity as a test pilot as well. And so to me, it's about making sure we're working towards long-term peace in the region. And, you know, having Jared Kushner over there working on redevelopment in Gaza is certainly not getting us to that point. So that's the framework that I would use to evaluate things in office.
You know, like 2018 with Governor Sherrilyn Spanberger, Senator Slotkin, Jason Crow, and others, you were one of a number of challengers with a military background this year. Kay Conley in New York, Joanne Mendoza out in Arizona, the Hellcats, I think you call them. There's even a vice admiral running in a Virginia congressional district. What added virtue and special quality do you think those with service backgrounds bring to Congress?
Yeah, well, you know, I'll just say that, you know, I appreciate you giving the Hellcats a shout out. I definitely love that group of badass women. And I certainly am hoping to follow in the footsteps of the people that ran in 2018 and flipped their seats. And, you know, I'll just say for me, I think it goes back to what we were talking about. You know, I literally put my life on the line for this country, as did all those other veterans that are stepping up to serve this nation in this capacity now. And so for me, it was about, I have two daughters. And so for me, it's about there's no way I was going to sit on the sidelines with everything going on in this country right now, because I want to make sure that they have just as many opportunities as I did. You know, I really consider my life a version of the American dream, because I was able to go to college on an ROTC scholarship and I used the GI Bill for my MBA, and my husband and I bought our house the VA loan. And so to me, that's the beauty of America, is you should be able to work hard and build the life you want to be able to build. And so I want to make sure my daughters and the next generation have those opportunities. But I think we need more people in office that are there for the right reasons and are going to put country over party. And that is how I think we're going to break through this gridlock, hopefully get rid of some of this corruption that we're seeing in Washington and actually solve problems for people.
You know, Rebecca Bennett, if you win after Mikey Sherrill, every young Navy helicopter pilot in America is going to say, I want to go to New Jersey and run for political office. Thank you for being with us. I'm sorry James couldn't join us, but best of luck, and we'll stay in touch.
It's all good. Thank you so much. Hope you have a great afternoon.
sleep comfortable with miracle sheets. It's great, and unless you think it's going to start getting cool, which I can assure you is not, it's a really good investment in the future. I think unbearably hot summers are part of our way of life here in the world, and you'd be really wise to use this and get a good night's sleep, and it'll be useful in years to come, I promise you.
If you wake up sweaty, freezing, or just uncomfortable, it's time to upgrade. The temperature in your bedroom can make or break your sleep. That's why you need to switch to Miracle Made Sheets. They're inspired by NASA technology and use silver-infused temperature-regulating fabric to help you sleep perfectly all night long. Sleeping at the right temperature is a critical way to feel rested the next day. And whether it's too hot or too cold, Miracle Made Sheets truly give you the maximum comfort. They make pillowcases and comforters also. Plus, thanks to their antibacterial silver technology, Miracle Sheets require way less laundry days because they stay clean and fresh three times longer. Not only is that fewer wash cycles, but it's great for your skin. Hidden bacteria can clog your pores and cause acne. So sleep cleaner and clearer with Miracle. Now, with no more gross odors, life's a whole lot better for your household. So join us in getting better sleep every night. Not only are Miracle Made Sheets smooth, breathable, and ridiculously comfortable, they don't have the steep price tag of other luxury brands. Miracle Sheets feel nicer than bed sheets used by some five-star hotels. So it's a vacation when you get into bed. I imagine myself going to some exotic spot. My wife and I are trying to pick out a vacation place now, maybe Italy, but anyway, it's your call. Choose Miracle to upgrade your sleep or give the gift of better rest. So go to trymiracle.com/war room to try Miracle Made Sheets today. You'll save over 40%. And when you use the promo code War Room, you'll get an extra 20% off plus a free 3-piece towel set. They make an amazing gift. And with a 30-day money-back guarantee, there's no risk. That's trymiracle.com/war room with the code War Room at checkout. Thanks to Miracle Made for sponsoring this episode, and the link is in our show notes.
Style your summers with Quince. Well, if you like money and you want to save it, then Quince is for you. And by the way, if you want well-fitting, well-made clothes, Quince is also for you. I mean, you don't give up anything at all by paying less money for this. And these clothes are well put together, well, and they're just good, and they're unbelievably cheap. I mean, you save a bucket load of money and you suffer nothing in terms of fashion or style.
One thing to love about summer is how easy everything feels. The days are a little more relaxed, and you end up reaching for the same comfortable go-anywhere wardrobe choice again and again. That's why we keep coming back to Quince. They focus on well-made essentials that naturally become those everyday staples you live in all season long. Quince's 100% European linen pants and shirts are breathable, easy to throw on, and the perfect summer upgrade, starting at just $34. Their tees are soft enough to live in all day, and the lightweight cotton sweaters are exactly what you want when summer nights cool down. Best of all, everything at Quince is priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Why? Because they work directly with ethical factories and cut out the middlemen. That means you're paying for exceptional quality, not brand markup. Now, James looks great in their activewear when he's running around on his farm. But one Quince favorite is their luxurious stretch wool dress pant. They feel amazing, and they're perfect for business on Capitol Hill or anywhere else, meeting a source or reading by the beach in style. It's not just clothing. Quince has become a trusted favorite for everything from home to travel to everyday essentials. So make your summer wardrobe easier. Go to quince.com/war room for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada, too. That's quince.com/war room for free shipping and 365-day returns. Again, quince.com/war room. The link is in our show notes. Hey, now for the outrage of the week. One of the sites that I look at most days is the Chronicle of Higher Education. You know, our system may be one of the best in the world, but we really have big problems. Affordability is a huge issue, much of it self-created. But the Trump administration and right-wingers have made it much worse. The University of Florida, considered one of the great public institutions in America, has now had two searches and picked two people to be president of their university. And they've all had to go through a process, which, among other things, they have to disown any statement or policy that they might have advocated about diversity, equity, or inclusion 10, 15 years earlier. It is a McCarthy-type litmus test. The Gainesville School has been one of the nation's best universities. It's not going to last for long with this kind of process. Free speech, an essence of a college experience, is under assault. Professors are restricted or being fired for what they can or cannot teach. Employees, listen to this, employees were fired for just commenting on slain conservative hero Charlie Kirk. Some of those employees have collected $3 million in wrongful dismissal suits. Scientists are leaving in droves. This is just one more price we are paying for this administration.
Well, I want to concur in the outrage. And the University of Florida is a great university, public university. And it's tragic how to politicize that place. And the consequence is going to be students that go to ask for people, or accomplished people, friends of ours that have degrees in there, graduate degrees, medical degrees, law degrees, business degrees, that their achievements are going to be diminished because of this kind of stupidity. For my outrage, I'll be short. It's actually to glorify somebody. If you believe, as I do, that winning is everything stupid and that we have to win these elections and they're critical and everything, I want to tip my hat to State Senator Mallory Morrow of Michigan, who I think showed real courage in seeing that her continued presence in that race would maybe positively affect the chances of Al Said winning the primary, which would be in most people's judgment, a step backwards. And so Barry, that was her dream, and she'll have a chance to run for something else. But my hat's off to you. You made a wise, patriotic decision. And I hope that Haley Stevens does well tonight. I thought and still think he would have been a better senator, but that's not the way things are.
James, can I tip my hat too to Mallory Morrow? I agree with you. I think she would have been the best candidate, but it just didn't line up that way.
Didn't line up. But at least she didn't. You know, she did what she had to do to make sure that we get to see, which I congratulate. Yes.
Yeah. No, I totally agree.
Drink the good stuff with Aqua Truth. I'm here in Innsbruck, Austria. And the one thing they got out of the way to tell you is the water is exceptionally clean and drinkable. That's not true everywhere you go. Everybody didn't have a mountain spring to provide, the water supply. So, yeah, let me tell you something. Clean water is one of the great luxuries of the civilized world.
Yeah, sure is. 3 out of 4 U.S. homes have toxic chemicals in their tap water. Now, that's shocking, and it's not good for us, our kids, or our pets. Even though contaminated water looks clear, it could put you at risk for devastating health concerns, including fatigue, hormone disruption, cognitive decline, even cancer. Despite what you may think, standard fridge and pitcher filters do little to remove most contaminants. And bottled water contains microplastics, which means you're just trading one problem for another. We knew there had to be a solution out there, which is why we want to tell you about Aqua True. Aqua True is a top-of-the-line countertop water purifier tested and certified to remove 84 contaminants, including chlorine, lead forever chemicals, and microplastics. It's a patent 4-stage reverse osmosis system that goes way beyond your ordinary filters to give you pure, healthy water you can trust. Best of all, It doesn't need plumbing or installation. Don't just take our words for it. AquaTrue has been featured in Business Insider, Popular Science, and named Best Countertop Water Filter by Good Housekeeping. It's got the Good Housekeeping seal of approval, James. So join 98% of customers who say their drinking water is cleaner, safer, and healthier. Go to aquatrue.com now for 20% off your purifier with promo code WARROOM. AquaTrue even comes with a 30-day best-tasting water guarantee. That's aquatrue.com. AquaTrue.com. Promo code WARROOM, War Room. The link is in our show notes. All right, now for one of our favorite sections, the questions and answers. We love getting questions from you all. Amy in California, James, says, women have led many nations. Some of these nations seem more patriarchal and bound by tradition in the U.S. So she asked a question that we really get from a lot of listeners. Why aren't Americans ready for a female president? Amy cried when Hillary lost and despaired when Trump was reelected. But she says that our irreverent but practical discussions keep her sane. So keep her sane and tell her, James, can America elect a woman president?
You know, I think yes. I think Hillary actually carried the popular vote by more than a little bit. She ran into a distributional freak. That was true. She was also running for a third term, which is extremely difficult. Harris came really close. She ran a lethargic campaign, didn't have any promise to change anything different. And I just don't buy it. I really, you know, women went like crazy in Senate races and places like that. And I think right. if we tell ourselves the reason that we lost is we nominated female candidates, I think we're misleading ourselves. And I think we're making an entirely wrong assumption. And I don't want to be in a party that just nominates males or just nominates males for president. I mean, maybe this cycle, the male candidates are stronger, but so be it. And by the way, our earlier conversation about Georgia, Georgia is the most important political state in the United States right now. And I make this prediction, a Georgian will be on the presidential ticket for the Democratic Party in 2028.
Okay, you heard it here first. They got several great possibilities for that too, James. Okay, another James, this one from St. Augustine, Florida, said, watching Mike Johnson play games with the swearing in of a new Arizona lawmaker, do you think Republicans in the House and Senate will just refuse to swear in new members if they're about to lose control? James, that is an issue that top Democrats are really worried about. There is focus on that. They will do anything to remain in power. They'll try to sabotage the elections beforehand. And if they lose, that's the kind of trick they may try to play. And the only thing I would say to Democrats, please, please, please have the best legal advice that you can have on this, because you're going to have to fight like hell because there's nothing that they won't do.
Yeah, I concur. And also just send as many early warning signals as you can. Warn people they're going to try this. The best defense against all this is an early warning system, some version of NORAD or whatever they called it. But yes, you cannot talk about it enough. It's too dangerous. And they're going to try it. And you're right. You have to have not just good lawyers. You have to have good preparation. You got to be ready to go when it happens to stoke what I think would be a huge outrage in this country. I think this is a lot harder to do than we think. I'm not saying they're not going to try it. But I think it's going to be very hard for them to do. Very hard, particularly when you're forewarned.
But they're going to try, no question. Yeah. James, I'd love to give you questions from New Orleans. And Andy asks, there's an assumption of Democrats win the House, I think a correct one, that House committee investigations will investigate and expose some of the Trump administration's corruption. But what would stop Trump officials from simply stonewalling and ignoring all those House committee subpoenas?
As of now, you can't ignore a subpoena. against the law.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's only got better have. I mean, it is the law. Now, who knows what these, you know, corrupt people would do, or, you know, the Supreme Court, which I have zero confidence in. But right now, you don't have a choice. You have to respond to a congressionally issued subpoena. I don't know what else. I mean, I get maybe they'll ignore
and,
it.
And what I should know, James, and don't know, is if you do, and if the House then brings a case against them, is that something the Justice Department has to then prosecute, or can they find an outside counsel to do that? I don't know the answer.
I think they'd have to refer it. There's certain penalties, but it could be. And you would have, you talk about a constitutional crisis. You have a duly authorized subpoena from the Constitution of the United States, and somebody refuses to comply with the subpoena, and the Justice Department says we're not going to do anything. I'd have to ask, like some of our better lawyer friends, could you go directly to a federal court to get it enforced? I'm just not a good enough lawyer to know, but it would set off a lot. It would be a major, major event if they denied a subpoena and the Justice Department didn't enforce the subpoena, but I don't put anything past them.
Our next question is from Robert in Glenpool, Oklahoma, my wife's birth state. Could Trump and his family be prosecuted by state's attorneys general for any crimes he committed in the various states while in office, Georgia election interference being an example? Robert, I doubt it. And that's because of that incredible June 2024 Supreme Court decision that basically grants him presumptive immunity for any action that he says is official. And he, of course, will claim every action is official. But I think that it's going to be up to state attorney generals to look at some of the other corruption in this administration down the road. All right. We love those questions. If we didn't get to yours this week, please send it in again next week, and we'll try to get to it then, because we really just love going through and deciding which of those questions we can use. Thank you for listening to Politics War Room. James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. As always, send your questions for us by email to politicswarroom@gmail.com or tweet them for next week's show at Politicon. Following this episode, we'd really appreciate it if you check out the links to our sponsors, Trust and Will, Miracle Made, Quince, and Aqua True, and our episode show notes. We deeply thank you for supporting them, because when you do, you help make this podcast happen. Now, to keep up with us, subscribe to Politics War Room on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And check out our Substack at politicswarroom.com. James and I are constantly adding new content, so go take a look. You can also find other shows you might enjoy on the Politicon YouTube channel when you search Politicon on your favorite podcast sites. Now, remember, please rate the show with a 5-star review. And we'll be back next week with another show as we continue our War Room planning.